I'm John from Head in the Cloud, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1...
Hello there, everybody. My name is Sophie Aldred, and I had the enormously great pleasure of playing the character of Ace in Doctor Who. And I would like to just remind you that you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. It's not private, it's public. And it means that you, the public, can listen to this Gallifrey Public Radio. And I'm very honoured to be on it and interviewed by it. So I hope you really enjoy the interview with me and all the other amazing stuff that they put out. And thank you, thank you, thank you for supporting Doctor Who all these years and for all this time. Because without you, Doctor Who wouldn't be the show it is today.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning. Welcome to episode 244 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where no matter which side of an argument you're on, chances are there's someone out there you haven't met yet who has a better costume and much better facial hair than you. And so clearly, they have you soundly beaten. I am your host. My name is Kieran. And joining me, as always, in the GPR studios is my partner in time, Jay Witten. Jay, how are you, sir?
I'm just waiting for the next person to come through the door and shake things up even more.
It's just never a dull moment. And over in the corner, who's kind of eyeing that interesting little vehicle that someone left the keys in, is Haley Malley. Haley, what's going on?
I just can't wait to lay down my guns and surrender again.
Then we'll turn the camera around and you can do it all over again in 20 minutes. And a very warm welcome to tonight's guest, who is a devout Whovian, writer and a fellow panelist on a number of occasions, Chris Coker. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure.
So this week we're returning to one of our favorite mid-season break pastimes, which is making Haley suffer through a chronological rewatch of classic Doctor Who episodes. So for those of you that are playing along at home, we left off in the Third Doctor and Joe Grant era, so we're up to Colony in Space.
Yeah. So, Chris, I know you have an interesting little backstory on this one that I want to let you get to when we break into this for a second. But for those of you who are just sort of getting familiar with where we picked the needle up off the record the last time we did our rewatch, so the Doctor has potentially been given the opportunity to get himself off-world. The Time Lords are conspiring to give him the ability to dematerialize once again, much to the convenience of the writers at the time, who are looking to mix things up a little bit. But, of course, they're doing so with one very large caveat, and that caveat has a really killer goatee and tends to dress in black a lot. So we always want to get started with first reactions, and we always point at Haley first because she's coming into these things most often for the first time. So, Haley, you've had a bit of a break, uh-huh. A reprieve, if you will, from Third Doctor and Delgado headbutting, and we're right back into the thick of it. How did you feel about Colony in Space?
Sorry, you cut out at the end there.
Oh, so how did you feel about Colony in Space?
It was a perfectly adequate episode. It's not one that I'm going to look back on and be like, oh, I got to go watch that one. But it was fine.
Okay. Very guarded. Jay, what about you? Had you seen this one before, or was this your first time through on this story?
Oh, no, I've seen this one before.
Okay.
It, it didn't hold up as well as I remembered in some aspects, but then other ways it was even better. Part of the reason was when I came across it the first time, it wasn't a chronological thing. I had been cherry picking a lot of classic stuff. So the appearance of the Master was exciting at that point. And he, you know, when he popped up again in this one, it was kind of like, oh yeah, it's that whole stretch that we're in right now. But, but no, I mean, it is a fun story. It's got a lot of great stuff to it, but then there's a lot of things that really bog it down.
Okay. Before I let you quantify what those bogging points are, Chris, I want to lob this into your court so that you can not only kind of give us your general opinion on the story itself, but also the fact that I know you've got
I hope it's a great little anecdote. You can decide for yourself. My public television station when I was growing up, used to show all the stories an episode at a time in the evenings. And at one point they switched to showing it in movie format on Saturday afternoons, like it was some kind of weird, like the movie serial, like to kind of fill time between This Old House and, Bob Ross, you know, like it was in there somewhere, whatever educational programming they could fit in there. But they had a really weird way of doing it because they really only left 2 hours for every story, which works fine if it's a 4-episode story. Even sort of a 5-episode story, you can kind of squeeze that in there, you know. But anything more than that was very confusing for whoever was the engineer in the control room at the TV station. So they frequently screwed up. And with this story in particular, they showed episodes 1 through 4. And when they made it to episode 4, the screen would just go black. Like there was no end credits. It would just end. Like it was black. And then it would be like their little Saturday matinee bumper that they would have, you know, that they would be like, oh, Saturday matinee on WVIA. So then I tune in the next week, and they re-show episodes 3 and 4.
I thought you meant like 3, 4, 5, 6.
Well, no, they only showed the 2 episodes, which was really weird. So they only had like an hour. No, they only showed episodes 3 and 4. And I was like, this is wrong, clearly. So I spent like the whole week, keep in mind, I'm probably like, 13, 14. I don't know anything about anything, but I spent the whole week like trying to call someone at the TV station and say, hey, you know, you guys screwed up. I'd really like to see the end of this story. Please make sure you show the end of the story next week. Of course, the next week, they just start right in on the demons. Like they don't even go back. So.
Okay.
It was really frustrating. And then a few months later, I happened to be in a library and I found the novelization of the story. And that's how I figured out how the story ended. Like then it was another 25 years before I actually ended up watching the final 2 episodes. It was a long time because I, at one point, maybe 5, 7 years ago, I sat down and I said, all right, these are the Doctor Who stories I've never seen. And those 2 episodes were on that list. So I finally saw them. And I got to tell you, the novelization is much more impressive.
I'm trying to remember from my Target novelizations. Did Hulk also write his own novelization?
He did. Okay. He did in this case. I don't know that he always did, but he definitely did in this case. And as you might imagine, the special effects are much better in the novelization. we can talk about that when we get to the end of the episode. But so it was a strange experience that somehow I figured out how the story ended by reading the book, which how often does that happen?
So that leaves you with a much different sort of overall impression of the story itself, I would imagine.
It does. I mean, it was a little bit disappointing when I actually saw the last couple of episodes because I thought, man, I imagined this could be a lot
cooler. So you're saying the book was better?
You know, like, Well, for instance, like, not to skip to the end, but when they get to the leader of the primitives, you know, who in the episode sort of just apparently lives inside a wall.
Yes.
Just kind of lives in there. Like, I don't know if there's Wi-Fi or cable TV in there or snacks or something. I don't know. But like,
he lives in a mini bar.
Out.
He actually is he in a mini bar.
Yes, that could be, and I bet each bottle of water is like $10.
Don't touch them; they're on little magnetic.
Touch them. Don't do it. But you know, in the book, like the guy is like this impressive being of light. Like he is like blinding light, and like speaks with this booming voice, and you know, is very impressive. Very impressive. And then you've seen the episode, and like there's this dude, like the wall comes up and the dude comes out and he's a puppet, and then when he's done saying his lines, he, you know, they close the wall again, and you know, there's just things like that that are just very obviously the special effects are better in your head.
The innocence of the late 1960s, I suppose. We're much better at suspending our disbelief at that point. It was probably the drugs. But well, I mean, as far as the structure of the story itself, I mean, Hulk is an exceptional writer, and Jay, I know you had mentioned that you had a bit of an issue, the fact that this sort of felt kind of West Wingy to a certain degree, and I got to give you credit, that was actually an intent. When Malcolm Hulk sets pen to paper, you end up very often with a very leftist story.
Mm-hmm.
What was really leaping out at you that just said, okay, this is a pretty liberal minded episode or story, I should say.
Well, it wasn't so much that it was a liberal, like a lefting story, but it was, to some extent it was. It was a lot of, you know, the common man versus corporation kind of thing where, you know, corporations step all over everybody and, you know, anything to make a profit, doesn't matter who gets in the way, who gets hurt, whatever. And obviously the doctor falling on the side of, you know, of the common man or the person that has the right to live his life as he sees fit, whatever. But then it was also a lot of, pseudo courtroom drama. So not even like actual courtroom, just, you know, you had
the tribunals. Everybody's got a tribunal.
Yeah. And I mean, at the very end,
Judge Master,
at the very end, when you've got the, you know, the kangaroo court that, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, this, we're having this session to determine whether you're right or I'm wrong, right? And they gave me the power to decide. So let's go ahead and hear your side of the story. Like, what the heck was that?
I'm going to hold myself to the greatest scrutiny. Yeah. I have to agree. I mean, there are a lot of moments that you tend to see rehashed. Not only just the courtroom scenario, or I should say the, you know, the, whether it's the adjudicator or the tribunals or however they want to spin it in that particular case, there's always somebody sitting behind a crystal decanter full of water waiting to pass judgment on somebody. But there's also things like some scene repetition with, as Haley mentioned, the gunfights.
Yes.
So literally,
tell everyone to drop their weapons.
Always in the same set. You just turn the cast around. Are you stand behind the box this time? And 20 minutes from now, I'm going to stand behind the box.
Seriously, somebody move that box.
As I was watching it, I sort of thought, and I'm sure maybe we can think of other examples, but is there any other Doctor Who story where you sort of have that reversal of fortune, like so many different times, like the colonists are on top, then the miners are on top, then the colonists are on top. You know what I mean? Like it switches so many. I honestly lost track. I was going to keep track, but I lost track. You know, I can't think of another story clearly that happens.
Not that many flips.
A lot in especially the classic series. Yeah. But I couldn't think of another story when it happens that many times where and you're right. I mean, it's they're always like repetitive, you know, gun battles, or you know, someone is being held hostage and then they're not, and then they're being released, and then so it was very. I couldn't think of another example that was quite like that.
Not with that much repetition. I mean, this really felt like. You know, it was there were 9 sides to this coin, and you just kept flipping it and flipping it and flipping it. I will say, to a certain degree, and it was something that kind of struck me by about the 3rd episode or so, that and it was actually something I was giving the story a lot of credit for, was that this wasn't just a matter of the typical kind of triangle where you've got 2 factions going at one another, and the Doctor gets plunged into the middle of it to try and mediate in some fashion, and he may lean towards one side or the other. But there were also aspects of dissension within the ranks of both sides. So you had Norton clearly acting as a double agent for the IMC, you know, because, well, you could tell that he must have been the double agent because he had the worst looking beard of all of them. and then you had Caldwell, obviously, on the IMC, who was like the thug with a heart.
You can tell because he had the good guy mustache.
Exactly. His was not nearly as sexy.
Everyone in this, all the men in this story had such great facial hair. Like, the ones that had the facial hair, man, were really rocking it. Like, it was amazing.
If you have not had an opportunity to watch through the full DVD set, and you can watch the bonus cut that's on there, which is the behind-the-scenes piece that they did for it called Colony in Space, the bonus, IMC Needs You. They do this little animated sequence to lead into all the interviews with Terrence Dix and Graham and everybody involved with it. And they start with this sequence that's basically a recruitment film for the IMC. This is, do you love beating up dirty hippie colonists? Can you grow sinister mustaches? The IMC needs you. And it's classic. It's just for that alone, it's worth picking up the DVD set.
That's good.
But yeah, I mean, because of that, because of the fact that you've got just the typical kind of triangle, and then on both sides of the Doctor's little you know, ping pong game, you've got these other little elements that are sort of muddying the waters a little bit or working against their side, and then you throw the Master in as well. It and then you realize, oh wait, there's more than just the primitives. Now there's these. I guess they were kind of referring to them as the priests or the guardians or however they referred to the giant brain ones. And then there's another one on top of that, you know, and it just got denser and denser. So I think that's probably what kept me from falling into a lot of the fatigue that I tend to experience with some of the longer, the 5 or 6 episode stories, because it kept saying, all right, well, you're getting a little bored with that. Here, take this. And thankfully it didn't feel like they were necessarily slapping an extra layer on simply for that purpose. I think Hulk's just a better writer than that, but I don't know. Jay, you said you kind of felt like they were, it got to that point.
I mean, a little bit. It kind of goes back to the whole back and forth that we had the whole time of, you know, this faction's in charge now, and now this one has the upper hand, and the whole time you've got this group over here that's doing their thing. And it was just, okay, so we've got the colonists, right? That's what we start off with. And we get the, okay, so maybe there's animals. No, wait, now there's the mining colony or the mining company that's there. And now we have these primitives to contend with. But wait, there's different kinds of the primitives. And now this one can talk. And it's just, and now the Master shows up. Just this one who, you know, it lives in a wall and you can actually see somebody's shoulder behind the chair. It's, yeah. But it just seems like it just, okay, who are we going to throw in now just to make things even more madcap? You know, it's
one of the things I wondered when I was watching it was, I wonder if Malcolm Hulk originally was given the idea to write this story. And then they said, hey, can you put the Master in there too? Like it almost felt like it was almost 2 different stories that they kind of jammed. I tried to do some research online, and I couldn't find any evidence that this is true, but that was the feeling that I got from it, was that he put in a perfectly serviceable sort of leftist story about corporations and colonialism and Native Americans was apparently one of his influences as well. But I almost wonder if, like, you know, Terrence Dick said, this is a great story, Mac, but can you throw some Master in there? Like, we're kind of doing that this season. And he had to figure out a way to like get the Master in there as well. I don't know. That's just the feeling I got from it.
That's a possibility. I'm not really sure. I mean, there seemed to be such a science to the way that they had handed writing opportunities over between Barry Letts and Terrence Dix at the time. They had such a formula worked out. And it was because of that very reason that they realized, okay, we've got to get the Third Doctor off planet because we've, you know, we've been working this for a little while and this horse is getting tired. But we're going to do so in a way that we can sort of dip our toes into it so that if it doesn't work, we can revoke that card. You know, if this story bombs, then we can just say the Time Lords never reach out to the Doctor again to put him in, you know, to basically make him a, you know, gun for hire at any point further on. But I don't know. I mean, I can see your point about the fact that there's sort of a duality to it, that it could have functioned if you were to draw the Master out of it and just keep a different adjudicator in there that didn't necessarily have any ulterior motives, and just
didn't go after the Doomsday device.
Yeah, well, but I mean, they had kind of. I like the idea of building towards that greater aspect. I like the way it kind of buttons up at the end that the Doomsday Weapon was the reason why the vegetation wouldn't grow and those things. That's just that's nice little clever buttoning. So it seems like, yeah, Master aside, he's got a really serviceable story there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know necessarily that having a, you're never going to tell me that I can't watch Delgado on screen, but I mean, it's just as far as his involvement in the story, I still think you get some very valuable things out of that. You get that great exchange between the two of them in the fifth episode, where the Master kind of reveals his plan. And he's basically appealing to the Doctor to join him. I thought that was exceptional.
Yeah.
That's like quote-worthy material right there because of the fact that, you know, together we can rule the galaxy. And then it went from the galaxy to the universe to the cosmos, the mind of God.
Rule all the things.
And what was interesting about that, obviously, in hindsight, is there have been echoes of that relationship in the 12th Doctor era with Missy, that, you know, she wants to be his pal and they can rule together and you kind of think, oh, well, that's kind of a weird thing to happen when you're watching the newer episodes. But then you dig further back and you realize it's always been in there somewhere. And it's just brought to the forefront more. When Missy and the 12th Doctor interact.
Yeah. This may have been, I'm pretty sure this was the first time there was ever that sort of that reach back across the aisle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, if Malcolm was the first one to sort of toy around with that idea, you know, we've been adversaries for so long from the same point of origin, we're both renegades and toying with that idea. It's quite a while before they may sort of it was touched upon in seasons to follow. You know, as you start getting in, especially with Seventh Doctor, you get quite a bit of that sort of tit for tat. But yeah, it isn't until you really have some exploration of the Master's character that isn't just mustache twirling. Well, because thankfully Michelle Gomez doesn't have a mustache, so you know they could really blow that up and have some fun with it. I have no idea where they're going to go with it now. I mean, this all bets are off, but yeah, this absolutely opened the door for it.
And there's also this weird idea that, like, if you have absolute power, you can use it to create peace.
Oh yeah. Well,
which is a very tempting offer if you're the Doctor. I mean, obviously that's the same offer that Missy makes to him in Death in Heaven, when she says, "Here's your Cybermen army. You can use it to make peace." So that it's an interesting idea, but obviously, it's rejected by the Doctor. He realizes that absolute power eventually is going to end up being a giant mistake.
As far as our character portrayals, what was everybody's kind of pull? I mean, we all love Katie Manning to absolute death. I mean, just you can't help but do so, and it's not just a matter of just what we know, you know, from our interactions with her present day, but at this point where they had gotten to this degree of the relationship between the Doctor and Joe, I mean, there was so much adoration between the two of them. It was such a I don't even know, do you want to refer to it as a kind of just this absolutely blissful paternal kind of relationship? I mean, how would you describe where the two of them are at this stage in their adventures?
It's kind of hard to say. They've definitely found their stride at this point. There's a camaraderie there. There's, you know, the Doctor understands the limitations of his companion, but also knows how she can, you know, be of help and that kind of thing. So it really is kind of that, I don't want to say teamwork, because there's a lot of times where it's just, you know, the doctor telling Joe to just go sit in the corner and stay out of the way while I solve the problem. So I can't really say partnership, but there is that camaraderie. There is that feeling of having a team.
Yeah. I see that. Every once in a while, one or the other will make a statement as they're speaking to another character, and they'll look to each other and drop the wink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yeah, you see where I'm going with this? All right, follow my lead, because I got this. And obviously, both of their opportunities to be as kind of physical as they can. You know, there's no reason to crawl across a laser beam that's a foot off the floor. You could just step over it, but no.
What?
I know.
You could step over it?
Wackiness.
Oh, man.
But then you wouldn't get the doctor's cape all dirty.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that shows that he means business.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
But what's interesting is they do have that relationship. But on the other hand, Joe admits that she didn't actually believe that he traveled through time and space. She says, you know, all that talk of yours about traveling through time and space, it was true. Like, did she just think he was just incredibly eccentric and maybe a bit nuts and just made this stuff up, and he really was just a human guy who had some extraordinary powers, you know? As it was just an odd moment where she's like, oh yeah, you weren't lying after all. Right.
I love the fact that since this does mark the point where Joe's realization of the universe just gets, you know, immensely larger, but she actually reacts to it with trepidation. You know, she's somebody who, on all their Earthbound adventures, as long as she knows the doctor's got her back, she's pretty fearless in her own right. You know, I mean, we know her background. You know, she's supposed to have all of this skill set. She's supposed to be quite capable of taking care of herself, and demonstrates that on a pretty regular basis, amidst a bit of screaming. But in this particular case, is, you know, the moment the TARDIS door is open and she looks out on an alien world, she's terrified. She just wants to go home. This is like about the limit of what she can take.
Right.
And I think that that's a really interesting portrayal, not only in terms of what Hulk writes into the script, but also what Katie ends up doing with the character. Mm-hmm. It's a point where she ends up really getting thrust into it, realizing that there's the safety of others involved that gets her to put that aside. As soon as she starts realizing about the colonists' plight, everything's off. You know, she befriends Mary Ash, and then she's off to the races. She's off being Joe again.
Yeah. And that, you know, that was the thing, was that this is not an adventure that she asked for. Like, she seriously thought that she was just going to be the personal assistant of this, you know, this brilliant scientist. And now all of a sudden she's, you know, hundreds of years in the future on an alien planet, and it takes her a minute to get her bearings. But once she finds herself a task to do, she's all in. You know, she dedicates herself and she goes for it full bore. And it takes her that while to recenter herself and get used to her new surroundings before she can do that.
Well, and also at this point, remember, she's only ever seen the TARDIS not work. So it works one time and takes her to another planet and another time. And she's like, I mean, it'll start again, right? Like, we can go home, right?
And not only that, but, you know, this is the first time that she understands that it's actually something more than just a blue box that sits in the corner.
Right.
What did she say as they were walking in? She's like, what am I going to find inside a policeman?
Yeah, exactly.
But meanwhile, you know, if you're the doctor, I mean, you've been stranded on Earth for 2 years, more than 2 years. We're not quite sure how long. And the first planet he gets to go to is basically a rock quarry. I mean, that hadn't been very disappointing for him. Like, because, like, you couldn't take me somewhere cool. Like, I end up in a rock quarry again. It's just, he's like, you know, another rock quarry.
I mean, this is Doctor Who. That's what we do.
Be careful what you wish for, because we're not too far from the Sea Devils, and it's going to get ugly.
True.
All right. And then, of course, we get lots of absolutely textbook Pertwee moments. A lot of hayas, a lot of Venusian Aikido. We do a lot of unnecessary driving of vehicles. Explain to me why the first time the doctor and one of the IMC thuggies get into the vehicle, which, by the way, if you watch some of the extra features, you find out that it's a Daimler Haflinger, which is this weird four-wheel drive German not really a mining vehicle. I think it was really intended for sort of swamp use. That he, the moment he saw it, he says, "I'm driving that." So sure enough, you know, Doctor gets picked up by one of the IMC guards, and he's driving. A second later, yeah. Why is he behind the wheel?
Right.
Hello, random person I just found on this planet who's only supposed to have dirty hippie colonists on it. Sure, you drive. It's okay. I'll tell you where to go. My foot was getting tired.
Well, I mean,
maybe the other guy called shotgun. I mean, we don't know.
Well, you know those IMC guys and their shotguns.
You know, you had to keep the gun trained on the doctor. So
there you go. Yeah,
I there's a reason.
Keep my eye on you, Mr. Band. Perfect. And then, you know, so we've got those moments, and then we've got you know, our tons of gunfights, and then for no reason whatsoever, a mud wrestling match.
Yeah. That was fun.
Was it really for no reason?
And it's like this weird gray mud. Like, it doesn't even look like real mud. It's like this weird gray, like, gunk.
Because they were in a rock quarry, so it's full of quartz dust. And they said, well, we need a mud fight. So they just brought in, like, a tanker truck and just hosed down this pit and said, all right, guys, go to it.
Yeah, it works much better when, you know, the contestant or the battlers are in bikinis. Just going
to
say.
I don't know that we wanted to see those guys in bikinis.
No. The last person I really wanted to see in a bikini was Winton, I think. Oh, I kept wondering through the entire story whether it was a legitimate mustache until I saw him face first in the mud and then get thrown into a water puddle and came up and it was still intact. I said, that's true facial hair.
Yep. Still straight.
Yep. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Little interesting piece of backstory I found was that Morgan's character, as the consummate, you know, death-dealing IMC villain there, was actually originally written to be a female character.
Huh.
And she was going to be the death dealer. She was going to be the heartless executioner on behalf of the IMC. And they got all the way down to the point where they were going to do their filming for it, and the BBC went ballistic and shut it down. But how cool would that have been of having this absolutely clinically cold killer who was the IMC thuggy?
That would have been pretty cool. That definitely would have changed things quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everybody in the crew was on board. You know, from Barry Letts on down, they were rare to do it. They're like, yeah, this is, they were at the peak of the women's liberation curve in the UK. I mean, and they were ready to go forward with it. And it was just somebody from the drama department stepped down and said, what the hell are you doing? No. They said, they told Terrence Dix it was going to be unwatchably kinky. Kinky was
what?
Their word.
That.
Somebody had some interesting peccadillos, let's put it that way.
So it just goes to show that the song remains the same. But hopefully we're tearing that all down, which will be a nice segue into what we'll be discussing momentarily. But it's sort of closing thoughts on this. Jay, you said that you wouldn't really consider this to be a you probably wouldn't put this on your list of episodes or stories that you were handing the uninitiated to say, you know, if you're doing your classic stuff and you're boning up on it and you want to get the Pertwee era, make sure you include Colony in Space.
Yeah, I don't know. It is a fun story. It is a lot of fun, and it does have a lot of the go-to elements that the Third Doctor's era was rife with. So you really wouldn't be that bad off to hand it to somebody and be like, this kind of sums up what it is. But there are times when it does tend to drag on, especially for people that are used to modern television, or, you know, new Whovians who are going back trying to taste it. It's a lot of discussion. It's a lot of back and forth of, you know, these people have the guns and now they have the guns and now we're trading the guns back and forth. And it can get a little tiring for someone that's not used to the pacing of the classic era. If there's somebody that's been working their way through the classics and they get a sense of it, then absolutely. I'm going to be like, no, you have to watch this one. Cause it's, you know, I mean, it's so quintessentially Third Doctor, but if they're just getting their feet wet, then no, I'm probably going to have them hold off a bit.
Understandable. I mean, as far as I think you hit it when you were talking about your first impressions for it, because you were watching things sort of asynchronously or anachronistically, and you weren't at Dr. Master Fatigue, that if you were just handing this over to someone and saying, you know, this is kind of representative of where, you know, where season eight really was. Granted, with season eight, I probably would hand somebody Terror of the Autons and just walk away. I mean, that's,
yeah.
You know, that'd kind of be my go-to. But I mean, as far as, you know, ticking all the boxes, this is a pretty strong one if you're not coming into it saying, all right, are we done with the Master for a little while? Can we? Oh, no. Okay.
You thought so, but no.
Yeah.
I mean, we made it through like a couple episodes without seeing him, so there was hope.
Except they give it away at the beginning. Because you have that scene with the Time Lords, and they're like, well, the Master stole the plans for the Doomsday device, and they just, you just know he's going to show up at some point. You know, it almost would have been better if you didn't have that scene, and it might have been a little more surprising.
Well, the Time Lords sent the Doctor there to deal with the Master.
Yeah, but by the time he popped back up, like, I was trying to regain my bearings on this episode or the story. You know, it had been a long time since I've seen it, so I was trying to remember where we were and things like that, and I had forgotten that they'd even said anything about the Master, and I was just, by the time he popped up again, I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Not in this season.
Yeah. Sir, not...
You don't get a single reprieve because we've got one more story to close out season eight in the Daemons, and that's another Master arc.
Spoilers.
What, the Master's in that one too?
Never.
Oh man,
the audience couldn't possibly. Man.
If you're seriously surprised by that at this point, having watched everything that's come before, then yeah, you're turning your geek card.
Well, cool. But Haley, I mean, all in all, would you consider this one that you'd given the opportunity to watch again? Or is it one where, you know, if it's on, I'll sit down to it, or I'll walk away from it if I see it on?
Probably when I would rewatch this is when I'm going to rewatch the whole series. It's not what I'm going to go pick and be like, yes, that's the one. That's the one I'm going to sit down and watch tonight.
Okay.
I think there's just more exciting episodes to watch that even have a lot of these same elements. You know, you can still get some Pertwee and Master and all that kind of stuff and be more entertained than you are with this one.
Gotcha. And Chris, in your pantheon, now that you've sort of, you know, filled in all the spaces after what your childhood abandoned you, would you consider this, you know, rewatch worthy or is this, you know, kind of high or mid, low in the list?
You know, as you said, I mean, it's, and as we've discussed, I mean, it is a quintessential Third Doctor story, for better or worse. I mean, there are some great parts of it, and there are some parts of it where it was clear that they were padding it out a little bit. I wanted to share two quotes about the episode that I found. The discontinuity guide, offered some praise for some of the ambitions, but also said it's rather like watching socially aware paint dry.
I don't think that was Paul Cornell's line. I think he stepped back from the keyboard when that line was written. He would speak more favorably.
And also, in 2015, Stephen Moffat did an interview with Radio Times, and they asked him what Doctor Who episodes he had been watching, you know, sort of on his own, you know, for fun. And he said, heroically, I got all the way through Colony in Space recently. That's a test.
Wow.
So apparently he sort of, although he also added, I loved it at the time.
Okay.
So it's one of those where, you know, the John Nathan Turner, the memory cheats, theory comes into it, where when he was younger, he thought it was great. As he's watching it as an adult,
gotcha.
He finds it a bit trying. And the pacing of it is just so, when you compare it to sort of, especially the whiz-bang pacing that you have today on the show, I mean, you could fit most of these six episodes into about 15 minutes, like, of the show as it's written now.
With a lot less model rockets on wires, yeah.
But that's the best part.
That is the best part. I mean, I will say watching the Master's rocket ship land was the most fascinating 37 seconds of my life.
But then it turns out to be his TARDIS. So he's very dedicated to this idea that he's the adjudicator. Like, he not only makes his TARDIS look like the ship, but he flies it and lands it as if it's a rocket ship, which I thought was very impressive.
Pretty good effect, I will say.
It's a good idea, I meant. The effect of it, I don't know, but the idea of it was pretty impressive.
I like seeing the inside of the Master's TARDIS personally. I like the fact
that he has filing cabinets.
Yeah, poking around in his filing cabinets.
Like, who's doing his filing? Does he have, like, a temp come in, like, and sort of file and scuff away, like...
That's where his first...
Does he have a drawer that's labeled D for Doomsday Devices?
Yes.
He has, like, three drawers labeled D for Doctor. Like,
That's where his last... That's where his last four regenerations went to. He spent them all filing. He's like, you know what? This TARDIS is a wreck. There's papers everywhere. I'm going to organize.
I'm going to file this stuff and make sure I can find it later. It's possible.
I got to regenerate. My back is killing me. I've been lifting these banker's boxes full of files all day.
Oh, and my eyes. They're really going.
Yeah, his vision starts to go. Yeah, well, the lighting is here. It's piss poor. Can't see anything.
Time to regenerate. I need better eyes.
Maybe this regeneration will have better handwriting. Seriously, come on.
God. Do you know how heavy this box full of stolen IDs is?
Is this demon or is this demon or lemon? What the heck, man? What was that
also,
last?
Yeah, where was
thinking?
His laminator?
Oh, the Master's laminator. Oh, that's my next prop for Galley. I'm gonna make fake IDs for everyone. Yeah. You heard it here first. All right, you kids feel like doing some news?
Yeah, let's jump into it.
Sure.
Jay, what's the first thing we got in the roster tonight, newsworthy?
So the first thing that we've got here is, and just because I know how much Keir loves the viewing figures, the review from the reveal of Jodie Whittaker as the 13th Doctor, actually they've released a lot of the viewing figures for that. And I'm not sure, this obviously isn't taking into account the people that were watching it live, because how do you differentiate? I'm sure there was a spike in the...
Wimbledon figures.
Yeah, in the because, you know, oh, hey, it's over. Okay. All the nerds turn on their TV and it's like, whoa.
it's one way to make the nerds watch sports.
Yeah, exactly. Yay, sports ball. But the BBC have revealed that the video online has been viewed over 16 million times.
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, how many times have you watched it yourself? Just, you know, trying to pick it apart piece by piece. But, you know, I mean, there were so many reaction pieces that I'm sure that's kind of a little bit bloated. But it said that on the 5 million viewers saw it on BBC One after the Wimbledon finals. Then it was also released on BBC social media channels around the world, and 9.8 million times on the Facebook channel. And then 2.5 million views on the Doctor Who Twitter account, making it the most successful tweet of all time for Doctor Who.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive.
Okay. Yeah. How many times have you been asked by, have any of you been asked by Muggle coworkers about whether you've heard the news?
My mom emailed me a link.
Wow.
Like the next day. She's like, here's a link to the news. And I'm like, It's sort of like the equivalent when I was in college. My grandma used to clip things out of the paper and like mail them to me. So now my mom is sort of doing the 21st century equivalent of that. She'll email me, oh, did you see this link about Doctor Who? And I'm like, oh, yeah.
All I can think of is that line from Arrested Development. Here's $20. Go and see a Star War.
Yeah. No, I actually had one of my coworkers that I introduced to the show come up to me about like 4 days after and say, you're never going to believe who they cast as the new Doctor. I'm like, have we not met? Are you unaware?
I let him run with it.
What's also interesting is the number of people who are friends on Facebook who say, I don't really watch the show, but I have an opinion.
Of course you do.
So, I mean, I guess it's good to have that kind of discussion. Maybe they'll tune in. Maybe they'll become fans now. We can only hope. I mean, there are many doorways into this room, so we can hope that it works out. But it's just been very funny that, because I would never say, you know, I'm not really a Harry Potter fan, but you know, this, that, and the other. That would just never occur to me. It shows the place where Doctor Who is in the pop culture.
By all means.
And the nerd
Speaking
pop culture.
Speaking of areas of nerd culture that catch the attention of non-Whovians, Jay, because of the name involved with this, I'm going to ask you to please cue us up for exactly what this lost episode, well, not really lost, never come to fruition episode was really all about.
So the Mark Gatiss was actually supposed to write a story for series 4 with David Tennant that eventually it wound up getting cut, but it was supposed to be an Indiana Jones style adventure involving Nazis and the British Museum all during World War II. And it, like most of Mark Gatiss' stories, the concept is really, really exciting. Like, it sounds brilliant. He was talking about the title, which was the Suicide Expedition, came from the idea that during the First World War, the museum staff and the British government and everyone decided that all of these priceless artifacts needed to be hidden away so that they didn't get destroyed. But people still needed to be able to see things. You know, they still needed to, as he says, they needed spiritual sucker. So they had about 300,000 Anglo-Saxon pots that they put in these museums and figured if the museums got bombed, then, you know, they're not really losing anything because they've got so many of these pots. So the story was supposed to be around, and Russell Davies said, okay, instead of World War I, let's add Nazis to it. And there was supposed to be like a museum full of puzzle boxes and sliding doors and traps and all things like that. So, I mean, it sounds really interesting, but it wound up getting cut to include the fires of Pompeii. And Gatiss has said that, you know, he doesn't really hold on to any hope that it's actually going to get produced at any point. He says, I would have liked to have had it done, but it was not meant to be.
Now since it took the place of Fires of Pompeii, does that mean that maybe Peter Capaldi would have been on there playing a Nazi? And if that were true, I don't know that he could come back and be the
doctor. He probably would have been like the curator or something like that.
I would hope so. But you have to think, he probably, you know, having seen Three Musketeers and other things where he has been a villain, you have to think he would probably be pretty good, like in the Nazi commandant kind of role.
Do you think he could pull off a British accent? Or a British accent, a German.
Yes, he could pull off a British accent.
a German accent? It would be sort of like a German-Scottish accent. Sort of like, I don't know if you saw that video that was going around earlier this week of Peter cutting a promo for Sci-Fi Latin America, where he did the promo in Spanish. But it was Spanish with a Scottish accent. It was really funny. If you haven't seen
Scanish.
It, I'll find it.
That reminds me of that one song, the Mexican Scotsman.
It's interesting that we mention Capaldi and projects that he may be working on down the road. He did actually bend the ear of Stephen Moffat at one point, saying that there was a 70s BBC comedy that he wanted to see come back so that he could specifically play one of the lead characters. There was the comedy series On the Buses, which had a really, really extensive run at the time in the 70s. You know, it ran for, I forgot how many seasons. They did like three sort of extended movie lengths out of it and so forth. But it was basically just this very kind of goofball straight-up comedy. Ran for 4 seasons, 4 years, 74 total episodes, 3 movie spinoffs, and was actually got 17 million weekly viewers. So pretty darn good numbers. And Capaldi was telling Moffat that he wanted him to revisit the concept and bring it up into the 21st century so that he could play the inspector. It caught my attention because I thought, all right, really obscure BBC comedies and so forth. And I could totally see him wanting to return to that kind of a character because it would give him a little bit of an avenue to sort of go Tucker again and get some profanity back into his dialogue. But obviously, when they got the opportunity to sit down with him and talk about it, he did sort of leave it because Capaldi can't give you a single week without making you cry. So he wanted to make sure that he shared a few anecdotes and talked about his leaving the program. So, you know, he sort of commiserated with Matt Smith about the janky knee thing that happens every time you run down corridors and then have to pivot 180 degrees in order to deliver a line. That's going to lead to some injuring. And then just obviously just, you know, saying that he went out on what he could have, what he perceived to be one of the highest notes possible. And so looking forward to seeing that happen. Last thing I put in here is not really news, but I have alerts that go off and every device in my house starts to freak out every time the Valyard is mentioned online. So if you really want to wake me up in the middle of the night, just start putting blog posts out there about the Valyard and I will
not sleep. Is that like the bat signal? Like what does that look like exactly?
It's basically, it's eyebrows and a really bad hat. Yeah. It's just a helmet. It's just the silhouette of a helmet. It looks a little bit like Mega Man, but it's not really Mega Man.
The best part, nice, though, is him tripping over cats as he tries to turn off the alarm before the baby wakes up.
Yeah, oh, it's nigh impossible. But yeah, so this was just a quick sort of theory floated out there by a blogger for one of our online periodicals. And they were basically saying that, you know, with Jodie Whittaker as the 13th Doctor, and now everything sort of being turned on its ear as far as what you could do for companion pairings or non-pairings or you know, returns to classic villains, what do you do with those things? His supposition, this is Corey Plant writing, had said that this would be a great opportunity to bring back the physical manifestation of the Doctor's darkest sides in the form of the Valyard. I mean, if you choose to, based on what you get out of Trial of a Time Lord, you get certain things out of it as far as understanding exactly who the Valyard is. It's been explored much further off screen, clearly, but he's become a fascinating character. And one that I'm personally, I think, would make a phenomenal return. We've been talking about this for years about, you know, when would be the right time? All right, when are they going to play the Valyard card? But not yet. So this will be my once a year appeal to everyone to go watch Trial of a Time Lord. Set some time aside. It's going to take a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's worth it because this is old Sixie at his absolute best. But yeah, the Valyard is a phenomenal character. Michael Jayston does a great job of making him just as devious as possible, but really believes that he's got the right hand in the upper path, because he is literally, if you want to take it from canon, he is the manifestation of the Doctor's darkest persona elements. And so he fits in somewhere into the regeneration cycle, whether that's before, during, or after the original 12, we don't know. That's up to Chris Chibnall to decide when he uses the Valyard, because he will use Divine.
Now here's the thought that I just had. If the Valyard is supposed to be a mirror of the Gawker, would that mean that if the Gawker's a woman, then the Valyard would also be a woman?
Absolutely could be.
There you go.
And I've got casting already happening in my head.
I'm copywriting that idea right now.
I have at least four actors in my head that could do that right now. But
see, you just went and broke it all for me, because I was like, no, I'm totally on board with this as long as we get Benedict Cumberbatch playing the Valyard, because he can look the part.
He does look. Yeah, I've seen the shots where they've put their profiles side by side. Slap that little Lego helmet on top of Bendy Hoop's you know, cucumber's head. And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But how does he look in the robes? Does he look okay or
dashing?
It's not Benedict Cumberbatch. He looks brilliant in anything.
That's true.
There has to be a large fan blowing the robe back. Get a hurricane fan. Yes.
At all times.
Oh, well. But there you have it. News for the week.
All right. So what are we doing next week?
Well, it's I'm not going to explain this too much, because we're really going to be doing a lot of the seat of our pants, but that's one of the ways that we tend to flourish, especially when we're doing things a little unorthodox. We've gotten a chance to get to know some of the folks from over at the Coal Hill AV Club, another Whovian podcast, that tend to stray the musical route every once in a while, both in enjoying things, songs that may be tangentially related to their Whovian discussions, or at times writing material or parodies themselves. For those of you who have ever met Andy Hicks, you may have seen him at the Regen Who conventions, actually portraying the 12th Doctor, often in epic rap battles against Davros himself. videos out there. Go ahead, look it up on YouTube. It's a fascinating throwdown. But Andy will be joining us next week to do what we can only refer to as Gallifrey the Musical, which is sort of the thought of what's happening if you were to view episodes that you know very well, but they were done in sort of a Scooby-Doo or the Monkees style, where in the middle of the plot development, they suddenly break into a related song.
Oh, God.
Just happens. You know, what type of number is it? I don't want to over-explain this. Just let that stew in your head.
I'm speechless. I need to tune in for this one.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to have – I think Andy and I are going to try to get to composing really quickly, but I don't know. This may just be a discussion rather than actual karaoke time, but one can only hope. But, Chris, we absolutely want to thank you so much for spending an evening chatting with us about Colony in Space. Hope you'll consider joining us again.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me, and I could come back anytime.
Our pleasure. If people want to, you know, check in with you, you know, pick your brain on things, or just hear what it is that you're up to within the Whovian scope or out, how can they do so?
Well, I mean, you can always find me on the Facebook. We'd love to meet you on there. I have a radio show that is here in Binghamton, New York, and it is also online. You can find it at radiofreesignal.com, and I have some Whovian interviews up there from past conventions that I've had the pleasure to do. So feel free to find me.
Excellent. Will do.
I would love it.
All right. Well, this has been episode 244 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, well, that was a short trip. You'll never get that thing working properly.
And this is Kier saying, I urge you not to trust this man. He's an imposter.
And this is Haley saying, doctor, come back at once. Did it work? Is the doctor back?
Give it about 3 seconds and we'll show up on the other side of the room.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.